on.
All to order the regular meeting and public hearing of the North Bend Planning Commission for Thursday, January 10th, 2019. This is Commissioner Heller speaking. We have Commissioner Bovers in the room. And Commissioner Ryan.
Mr. Ryan's present.
Commissioner Miller.
Present.
And Commissioner Greenberg.
Here.
And Commissioner McFarland is absent, and Commissioner Tao as well. And who else we have in the room?
We have a quorum, yes.
I am Leonard Jordan, Department of Ecology, Senior Shoreline Planner.
And also staff, Mike McCarty.
And Jamie Burrell.
All right, sounds good. Next up is the approval of tonight's agenda.
So what?
Second.
Second, all right. Any comments or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving tonight's agenda, say aye.
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 And none opposed, so we're going with the agenda. And then next up is approval of last meeting's minutes, which was back in December 13th of last year. Motion?
Motion to approve.
Okay.
I'll second.
Second by Mr. Bovers. Anything concerning here? Looked good to me.
I believe the vote for Commissioner Tao's friendly amendment. The vote 4-1, I think I was the dissenting vote there, not Mr. Ryan.
Okay. That sounds familiar now.
Line 29.
Right.
Okay, about paying the impact fees.
Right.
Yep. That sounds correct to me.
I didn't hear. You're making a change.
Yeah, line 21 on the minutes from last time.
Page 1 of which?
Page 2.
Oh, 21, not 41.
21.
Line 21.
21.
And we should make sure that line...
That 41 is correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is 41...
I think
the overall item, yeah. I think.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was approved. I dissented on it.
But 21, okay. You... Okay.
Okay.
Got it.
All right, all those in favor of approving last meeting's agenda with the edits, say aye.
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 Just minutes.
Minutes, yeah.
Minutes?
Yes,
okay. Minutes, thank you. Okay. Those are approved. And then concerning those minutes mainly is what you've, or this is what I will sign.
That, I believe, is the...
some of that... your editing was related to this River Run development agreement?
Right. There's nothing in there about your vote. I'll double check, but that is the staff report that I sent around for the River Run. Yeah,
okay.
But nothing about your vote, so
okay.
I'll make sure that there's a non-issue. I think you're okay to sign that.
Right.
And I think I said in the email that's going to council next meeting. So. All right.
All right, it is 7:03, so we can proceed to the public comment on non-agenda items. We don't have any public in here, so we will move on to that one. Do we need to wait till 7:05?
It's 7:04.
Okay. We probably should, just because.
We can hold it open for.
I know at least at my work, we've had some challenges with that.
Yeah.
Not often, it's been very infrequent, but someone on a conference call, someone's going to call in at a specific time.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, meeting flow was different, so we already went over that. It was a little awkward, so.
Right.
Yeah. No.
You could always reopen the hearing if somebody else comes in later, too.
Okay.
By the time we talk about it for another 40 seconds, and go.
I'm watching.
Official Apple time.
Okay, so this was up the public hearing for amendments to North Bend Municipal Code 18.10.050, performance standards regarding upper car storage. So this was a new one that came up with
Correct, yeah, we could give a summary of the amendment. So we, as you guys know, we worked, Planning Commission worked really hard in 2018 on the permitted uses table, the performance standards, and everything is going really well. I think we've made a lot of really good amendments. One that's come up that is a bit concerning has been people contacting us that want to store cars and temporarily, basically to have extra fleet for their dealerships in other cities. And so there's a bit of a loophole there in the 2.29C, the outdoor storage of boats, cars, campers, etc., which is allowed in the urban separator overlay district and the EP2 zones. And there's not a benefit to the city by storing cars. You know, the point of sale doesn't occur there, the business doesn't occur there, the employment, and we don't, that's not what we want to all be. So that's where it came out of. So we proposed the clarification, which I can just read. Outdoor storage shall be associated with permitted on-site business and where point of sale occurs within the city. Outdoor storage may be permitted as a business that provides rental space for the convenience of individuals wishing to store their personal boats, campers, etc. Outdoor storage shall not be allowed for one business to utilize the site for storage for a remote business or when no other on-site business functions are offered. So we wanted to still have the flexibility for residents to have, you know, RV storage and whatnot, and we removed the word cars from the title there. So we think that will clarify the issue, and we won't see that use.
Does this allow for someone to rent out to a company for rent for storage?
If it were...
it says individual here, but...
Right, individuals. And then it has just boats, campers, et cetera. So...
So I think the intent of that is no.
Yeah, the intent is no. And because you need to have your business and your business functions on site, you know.
But if you're renting to someone else,
right,
that would be, you know, as a small business making money with an empty lot you have.
Right.
Renting that out for storage.
No, wouldn't be allowed. Mm-mm.
Comment.
Mm-hmm.
First, may I plead with the staff to rewrite. Get rid of the extra toys comment and just make it belongings. A little more professional.
Where is that one, Dan?
The outdoor storage per use, 2.29C is, so that sick little paragraph down. For using the store their extra toys.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That's just, well, it's a pretty strong bias.
Oh, within.
That's just a comment for this one.
Right. Yeah.
That's just a comment for us, not for the that would
yeah.
be going to
oh,
code.
I see.
Okay. Because
right.
of the public, I think we should.
Right.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, so this is staff's opinion, right? But does the Planning Commission have a different opinion?
Yeah,
that's
you
up
could.
To you.
Yeah. Did you want to open and close the
yeah,
public
let's
hearing
just, let's open,
and get that taken care
let's
of?
Let's open the hearing because these questions are part of it, even if there is any comments. So,
okay.
Know, it's. It's officially open at 7:08, but yeah, we've already been discussing a little bit.
Okay, and no one's here to comment, so close the hearing?
Sure, we'll close it
Kay.
At 7:08.
Okay.
Yeah, my question was, I guess, process-wise, you know, kind of reacting, I guess, what it sounds like to something that we don't necessarily want within the city.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, I kind of see where you're coming from. But it's a little, I don't know what the process is, if those kind of things are allowed. It seems like the other changes have been challenging and lengthy.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of an interesting situation where something that was just approved and then making a quick edit, and
mm-hmm.
I think the city council can approve it. So how does that
So we did have to notice, I don't have the date exactly, we had to notice... it was mid-December, you have to give a 60-day notice. You still have to issue a SEPA. So you have to give a 60-day notice before you can adopt. So I don't think that City Council could adopt till February. And we had to issue a SEPA and put it in the paper, and you guys had to have a hearing. And so, you know, that's all part of the process. So it is one of those things. We can't always anticipate everything in the code, and we prefer not to be reactionary all the time. But this was one that was concerning because it kept coming up, and it really doesn't fit the vision, I don't think, of what we've heard people want, you know.
What was the location? Were you able to say
that? I know there was some in the urban separator. Mm-hmm. Do you remember? Even over
Chinook Lumber site.
Next to the current Chinook Lumber site.
Oh, okay.
And up in the properties.
Kind of high view areas.
Yeah.
And it's not just an aesthetics basis. It's also a revenue basis. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And a benefit to our local residents. So we're taking on impacts of this use in terms of traffic and other things, but not getting the benefit to our residents that a business within the city would generate.
I think this is a good use to permit. I think that it's pretty visible, vastly, under utilized sites. Show some action going on here. It'll stimulate other action. The use of like the old Tanner Mill site, I've longed to see something even begin to happen. It's just nothing happened. When I kick a rock, that's the only thing that happens out there is the rock moves. This is transitory. This is not going to be permanent. This is basically parking cars for sale in the urban area, and that's, you have to go somewhere. I see Kent does a lot of that. A lot of open space, or maybe the space is more permitted for car parking. But I see this as an opportunity to show that we're doing some kind of thinking about using these spaces and generate the conversation that, okay, we don't want cars there. What can we get there? It helps to drive the conversation about something that's happening in town. And it'd be worth getting the conversation going, if nothing else, to let that happen on a temporary basis.
So the temporary basis, that's, I think, a great idea. The concern, I think, with a lot of this is that once it's there, it prevents other higher and better uses from occupying the site or coming to the site because it's no longer available. But if you were to establish some kind of time limit under which these can be permitted,
that it's up to the landowner, whoever owns the Tanner site, if they want to. And right now, I've seen occasionally where the casino uses that site for overflow parking for big events. That's parking cars. But using that site for some purpose rather than nothing is better. And I think we can write our ordinance to require that to be temporary. Use until the owner has a permanent use for that site. But I wouldn't take it out of the hand. I also think another location would be Truck Town. I mean, where else but we have trucks parked there in high densities every night, every day. Parking a couple hundred cars out in that neighborhood wouldn't do anything to the neighborhood in terms of a negative impact. And there again, we're using available space. I think it's important that we show that we're doing something with this property, that we're encouraging use. It's not the final use, but we're trying to get use out of it. So that's my comment. So I wouldn't just build a wall against it. I'm trying to figure out how we can use it to our advantage. That's my comment.
Now, if this was coming back to kind of what I was saying, if someone was to rent out their property for storage, that does see sales tax benefit back to the city, does it not? As a small business?
No. There's no sale. If there's no point of sale within the city, then the city doesn't receive any tax benefit.
You're saying that business, though, is getting 150 per car in
there's parking a car there, right?
There's a business located in the city that is profiting from it, then yes, I think the city would get something of that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. Could this be a space that can be used for local events that are occurring somehow? That can be parking that...
Yeah, so that would be under a totally different permit process. We have a temporary use permit that allows special events and parking.
That does bring money to the city, though,
like
that way. Is that right?
That could, yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah, and... Like, for example, this could be Lexus of Bellevue. They're looking for to put 200 cars, and they're continually rotating it. They would have to come in and pave. They would have to come in and do landscaping and probably frontage and that sort of thing. And then they would have a lot of cars within that. And they wouldn't have an office. That's our understanding.
No building, no structure.
Correct. No.
They'd have security or something.
They might have security or lights or cameras, I would assume.
Lexus,
and,
they would probably have lighting, they probably have cameras, they probably have a fence.
Right.
Because they're not going to want to spend that time to have security all the time.
To help have the alcohol by.
And again, hopefully they're circulating cars through, so there's people there moving the cars.
But by the time they build all that, it wouldn't be temporary.
Correct.
Right.
It's an investment.
That's
why I think you'd have to go to location. If we want to have this, it would have to go to, you know, maybe a few specific locations. I don't know if that's too specific.
Yeah. It's already only allowed in two zones.
You're talking about Truck Town and the USOD, so.
Correct, yeah.
All east side of town, right?
No, the USOD is up in the north.
Oh, okay.
North, west corner.
I've seen this happen before. When I worked for the city of Burien, we had a lot of pressure to allow temporary uses, outdoor storage. It wasn't all these cars. Sometimes it was. And those uses are still there. And I think it's been 7 years since I've been in Burien, and those things started about 5 years before I left. Mm. So what was designed to be temporary ended up being permanent. The city is frustrated that they can't get rid of these uses because there's long-term leases on these properties, or in some cases, back when I was there, the people who wanted the storage actually purchased the property. So there's no motivation for them to sell to a higher or better use at this point, because they've got it there, they put in their investment, but, you know, whether we require paving and all that kind of stuff, so. So that's my comment on temporary uses. And I did have maybe a technical change I'll bring up. So in the last sentence of paragraph A, outdoor storage shall not be allowed for one business, et cetera, et cetera. And it says, or when no other on-site business functions are offered. If I read it literally, I could put in a coffee stand. And now I can say, well, wait a minute, there's other on-site businesses. I can do my car parking here now. So I think you just need to say something like, no other on-site business functions related to the outdoor storage offered. So
associated
that may be a problem too, but just something like that. I can come up with that language.
Yeah.
I personally like the idea of giving these lots a use. Right, they're looking at, especially the Truck Town lots that are the EP2. It'd be nice to have that being used instead of just empty space. But I don't like the idea of a long-term 7-year parking. That does, like you said, that does stop higher use coming in.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be difficult if we allow them, and we'll assume it's going to be there.
Could you put a time limit on it? A long-term time limit?
Yeah, you may have more experience with that, but what I would see is something that, some kind of provision that would tie the business license to a limited time frame, that it shall not be renewed beyond 24 months, and you cannot apply for successive additional 2-year periods from the same business, something like that.
Right, then you could probably see more of a temporary fence put up.
I don't know if you'd see it because of that, because of the investment you have to put in. You have to pave. You trigger stormwater. It's not going to be cheap.
Yeah.
So if you're only going to give them a few years, you're probably not going to get any anyways.
Well, they're right anywhere, but not to allow it. They want to go through that expense.
It might be a different way to say no.
Yeah, correct.
Right. I mean, they don't have to park somewhere, but I can park in Arizona.
Right.
But yeah. We make a lot of conditions on our permits that do make people decide if they really want to do this. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't just not allow it just because it doesn't feel good. Mm-hmm. It can be good. Mm-hmm. But I think it'll stimulate interest. Move that parking lot around where you know, by Nintendo, out wherever we have open space that's not being used, draw attention to it by having this kind of function.
Well, and also giving the property owner a use of something.
Yeah.
Right. I've been here for 9 years now, and I know those lots haven't had a whole lot of use.
Yeah.
I'm sure you guys have been there longer.
Yeah.
But I mean, it'd be nice to have something done on those lots. Well,
a lot of those lots out in the EP2 zone do allow outdoor storage now. So
okay.
That the reason for not seeing it is not because it's not allowed.
Okay.
It may be other reasons that they're
sure.
Trying to tie up a higher and better use. Or.
Well, see, I think one of the issues that you guys aren't allowing is that it doesn't offer any financial return to the city because it's not a city business.
Mm-hmm.
They're just renting the space to get
correct.
Business into Bellevue.
Correct. And Bellevue gets to free fall
that. At least the landowner's getting paid something. They're going to be paying taxes on it. So somehow the city's getting
right.
Something for it.
And I'm not sure if we could request a percentage of sales or we could ask our legal team, you know. If we could. Yeah, that could.
I don't think you can.
Yeah.
No, but as a small business, we could get something out of it.
Yeah.
Right. Not much, no.
Yeah.
Would there be a sign that mentions the business? Or I mean, I'm just trying to envision. Would it say Lexus of Bellevue, or would it not?
Probably not.
Okay.
I would guess they keep it fairly obscure.
Right. I would think they would, yeah. But obviously, if it's a whole lot of Lexuses,
yeah.
You could figure out.
They wouldn't. They haven't described any interest in having any sales. Does that take just a bigger area?
Then it's auto sales, which is a total land use category.
Yeah, and which is allowed. I can't remember all the zones,
yeah,
but in that zone and EP, yeah, in both of those.
It seems like also that it would also be something that maybe motorhomes would like to use.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they build motorhomes east of here. They want to bring it in here and park them for future
mm-hmm.
sale.
We have a marine interest, boat marine interest that's been talked about. We've always talked about maybe snowmobiles or uses like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a point in favor of approving this the way that it is to just get the business that you know, would provide tax benefit to the city and maybe be more desirable and maybe be used by North Bend citizens. So that's why I think we would approve it as it is, the way I see it.
Can I offer a suggestion?
Sure.
We've been talking about except for remote, not allowed for a remote business. I would add in there outside of the city, because if it's a business within the city that's looking for additional storage, then their business function, their point of sale, the revenue, et cetera, is still occurring within the city. So we might want to just add that clarification in that last sentence there.
What was it again, Mike?
If you're looking at the red line,
mm-hmm.
the second to the last red line, not allowed for one business to utilize site for storage for a remote business, and then add in there outside of the city.
Scott, what are your thoughts? Where are you at?
I'm supportive generally of what the staff has presented with a couple of changes, and I wanted to run, if I can, run a couple other changes by you, maybe. So this is, again, I'm looking at the, how the code reads, and I always think about if I was going to challenge this, what kind of open gaps are there in here that we might need to fix. So the first sentence is telling where out, stating a limitation. That outdoor storage has to be associated with permitted on-site business and where point of sale occurs. So, okay, so that's the first sentence. The second sentence also says that it might be permitted if it's rental space for individuals for personal items. And then the third one is it's not allowed for one business for a remote, it's not allowed for one business to utilize a site for storage as a remote business, and then Mike, you just added, or it could be in the city, but I think there's some negative, double negatives there. It's not allowed for a remote business, but then you said it would be allowed for business that was within the city, but then the sentence before that says it's only permitted, it's a business if only permitted for individuals. And the first sentence talks about being permitted for an on-site business. See what I'm saying? There's so many different clauses there. I think it could be simpler by just saying what it's allowed for, maybe. I haven't thought about how to restructure that, but I mean, I would support the language that you presented with the idea that you could finesse it a little bit just to make it read better.
Yeah, and the tricky part is because the category is outdoor storage of boats, campers, well, taken out cars. So we've got those different uses.
Do we have residential or other types of uses like residential adjacent to outdoor storage zones? Any chance this use could be actually putting them into a residential community, which would not be acceptable?
It's possible, depending on where. I'm thinking within the neighborhood business zone that abuts
EP,
or cottage, abuts cottage zone. So you could see that adjacency. But with any outdoor storage use or any other use, it's going to have buffering requirements, so they'll have to provide a landscape buffer at the edge of the property.
Could this use be put into to an industrial or light industrial park, which would be outside of a residential?
Right. Up in the U.S., so do you have that area that's,
I'm fixing around the larger empty spaces in town that there might be 30 acres adjacent to a residential community. We'd never want to see a car lot.
Right.
I have a quick question. Would this include construction equipment at all?
No, that's under a different category. There's something called a construction yard, so it's intended for construction companies. But that's got somewhat of the same idea, that that's for a construction company operating on the site and not remotely storing equipment.
Does the other code keep you from, if you just strike cars, are you not going to get et cetera as an argument that cars are et cetera?
Well, this is where I was, to add on to that. I actually think you might not need to strike cars. Because in the second sentence there in red, it says outdoor storage may be permitted as a business that provides rental space for the convenience of individuals wishing to store their personal boats, cameras, etc. So the way I read that would be a storage unit place or something that's outdoor. So just for individuals.
Though. Classic Mustang. That you're
So I don't see why cars couldn't be included. You know, what you're talking about is just not a whole, you know, the business in Bellevue wanting to put, that's an off-site business, put all their cars there. So I don't know if you need to call out cars, even. Because it's being restricted in there.
Are we talking about warehouses?
No, it's like outdoor storage.
If I was like a Cabela's or I want a warehouse for my Cabela chain up and down I-5, store.
Yeah, and you could do that.
I can do that here.
Correct. In a building, sure. You can do anything.
So that would be an enclosed building. Mm-hmm. But these cars would be out in the open.
Correct.
So if they had an enclosed building.
Correct.
Yeah, it's indoor
That's
storage
totally
is a
different
category.
Yeah.
It's allowed in a lot more areas.
Right, unless it's not one of them anyway.
I mean, the reason I guess I'm for this is just because we have a car lot right here in town that's very out of place, you know, and that
yeah.
It's a local business. I'm sure lots of people support it and may know the owners and all that, and it has a lot of purpose, but it also doesn't fit at all. It will continue not to fit to have all those cars there. So I think the location's important if we're going to have something like this, and it's easiest to just not allow it. It's kind of the way that it's written for now. And maybe in the future, once we actually get some business here, then we could be a little bit easier to say, all right, well, we have some basic businesses and services, and we designate this area over here. I'm just not really sure. I'm assuming that's why it's coming here, because it's very early on in our business development. We have a lot of housing coming in, and the businesses have not caught up yet, so to allow this the way that it is. That could be one side of it. The other side, this could be justified through the tax and the financial benefit mm-hmm. to the city. I'm not exactly sure what trumps the other, but to me, I see it as taking away from other businesses that might provide services to North Bend citizens.
What other communities around here have permits to allow this type of use?
You
looked into the
Yeah, like you said, I think down south, South King County area is where you might see it. And you said the city you worked for.
The one I know of that's similar is down in the Kent Valley. There's a lot of vehicles that come in from Detroit and Japan and whatever, and there's huge parking lots
yeah,
there.
Real.
That
see
yeah.
Real.
Yeah.
SeaTac has that too. But that may be part of the port land.
Mm-hmm.
Part of land owned by the Port of
mm-hmm.
Seattle,
yeah.
So it might be where the cars come.
Mm-hmm.
That might be their land.
Yeah,
it's different land use regulations. Mm-hmm. Don't
I'll get off my high horse.
So I
have an idea about this.
So I've been working a little bit on the wording, and I think I can simplify it.
Okay. Sure.
So let me read it through, and then I can go back through it.
Or you can give me your edits if everybody's on board.
Okay, so outdoor storage shall be allowed, or permitted, whatever you want, for, colon, and then you just break down this paragraph a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So for, and the first one would be, a permitted business where point of sale occurs within the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then the only other thing would be, the second one would be, for a business that provides rental space for the convenience of individuals wishing to store their personal boats, campers, etc.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you take care of it in the city part by adding it in the first sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And then really I think the intent is we want the point of sale to be within the city. So I don't think we need all the other language about when it's not allowed, because
mm-hmm.
we're just saying when it is allowed.
Yeah.
Just thought.
That sounds good.
Okay. So, outdoor storage
yeah.
shall be allowed for, colon, a permitted business where point of sale occurs.
Within the city.
Within the city.
Or
a business that provides rental space for the convenience of individuals. And the rest of that? Okay.
Up to et cetera. And
okay.
Then you drop the rest.
And then drop the rest.
Because if you look at that third
mm-hmm.
sentence,
right, it's kind of repeating the. Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of looking at it a different way, but it's
mm-hmm.
repeating it. I mean, yes, you could have outdoor storage for rental
mm-hmm.
business. A Chevy dealer could
right.
rent land out in Trucktown. That's a remote business, but the point of sale is taking
mm-hmm.
place within the city.
Okay.
And then, when no other on-site business functions are offered, well, if you do have on-site business functions, the sales occurring in the city for the sales.
Okay.
Kind of way I look at
it. Okay.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Dick, to get to your idea, we do have on the agenda to bring to the Planning Commission our temporary use regulations in the near-term future. And one of the intents of that is to make it simpler to allow temporary, longer-term temporary uses that bring that kind of benefit, but then don't require the full gamut of frontage improvements and full landscaping and everything to enable exactly that. So you'll see that coming up here in, I think, March or April.
And two things. Other cities' codes related to this? Is there any?
I didn't look into that too much to see what others are doing.
How? So did this change originate in the CED committee?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
What were their? Did they have anyone that was not?
No, they generally were all on board with it, just for a lot of the same reasons you guys have talked about. Point of sale being a big one, and just benefit to the city, not what we ultimately want to see. We're really trying to be business friendly and get a lot of, drum up a lot of different ideas and uses, but this wasn't one that was really attractive to them, so.
Other thoughts?
No, I think I'm not a big fan of it in general. But if it does, if you're going to pass it, I would like to see the edits. Commissioner Greenberg said.
With the approved edits?
Yeah.
Well, if we can just provide those tonight, it would be nice if we can just get your recommendation and move it on after tonight.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's fine. What you said was, those edits, I'm okay with it.
Mary?
I agree with the edits.
Dick, any changes?
No.
You're on board?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so we do a motion to,
motion
to approve an amendment to the North Bend Municipal Code Table of Performance Standards 18.10.050 as amended this evening.
I'll move that.
Okay.
Second.
Commissioner Miller. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed? It moves forward. All right. Thanks for working through that, everyone.
A little bit late on our second hearing.
Supposed to be there at 7:10.
Or 7:20.
Oh, 7:20.
Yeah.
All right. Next up, we have the public hearing, which is amendments to North Bend Municipal Code 14.20 shoreline regulations. So we'll just go ahead and open up the hearing now.
Sure, yeah, this I can give more of an introduction after, but this is a second hearing, so somewhat optional, but it's been some time since we've reviewed. We had a joint critical area ordinance hearing and shoreline back in August, and because we've been working on the draft and have that available, we wanted to provide another opportunity to have a hearing.
It's 7:38. Did you have any comments you wanted to make on that? Thank you.
We did receive an email, which I passed around, Monday, January 7th, 2019, from Jean Buckner, and I was able to, I believe, address most of her questions and comments. So if the Planning Commission wishes to discuss any of that or go over any of that, we can. Otherwise, we can.
Jamie, I'm sorry, I just got comments from you.
Here, I'll pass around copies. Gene Buckner emailed comments, questions on the draft amendments. And so our emails chain more starting at the back going forward is who's in the email.
And I guess Jamie should, because there's not going to be anyone commenting, should we close the public hearing?
Sure.
Okay, so we'll close the public hearing at 7:39.
Okay.
And we'll move into planning commission deliberation and ratification.
Okay. So, this is a large chapter of code, and in your packet provided a memo which goes through kind of the high-level summaries. We also have a checklist from Department of Ecology going through the amendments. This, I would consider these overall, it's minor amendments that it's called a periodic review. So a check-in, how's everything? Some of the major changes that we looked at, and you can go through and go through a lot of pages where you don't see a lot of track changes. And so hopefully everybody's focused their review on where they see changes. But we clarified when you're in shoreline jurisdiction was one of the things. Before, it was just unclear in the code if you have a property and a corner touches in shoreline jurisdiction. You know, do I need a permit? Do I have to go through that review? You do not if your development isn't within that area. Another administrative clarification was on setbacks, and we already defined that in our zoning code, and the important piece in shoreline is more impervious surface and limiting that in the shoreline. The other thing that you guys worked a lot on was taking out the critical areas regulations. So that was Article 4 of this, and that's where you'll see the strike through. Now we're referencing that so that, that's consistent. And similarly with the tree preservation, we're referencing that section of code, and the flood, we're referencing that section of code. If there was anything else, a few other, like I said, minor updates just to be consistent with the Department of Ecology guidelines. So I'm happy to go through any of the amendments if you guys want to, just to refresh you, or I can actually pull it up on the screen too. And I did bring, I think I passed these out when we started, but the shoreline map. Now, one other actually big thing to point out is that our potential shoreline jurisdiction, the way our mapping has these areas as potential, then when you come in for a project, you would delineate that that shoreline area, which is generally 200 feet from an ordinary high water mark. So from the major type F streams. Right now, we have in we've included in our shoreline jurisdiction potential wetlands, and we've talked to our consultant and ecology, and they've said, you know, those are potential wetlands. You don't need to include that in potential shoreline jurisdiction. If there's not a wetland, there's no shoreline jurisdiction. So actually, I think you'll see a lot of this area shrink quite a bit. So that's important to know. And I will have draft maps here shortly, but our GIS person is finishing them up.
Can I just say, I really appreciate seeing these visual
aids. Yeah. Oh, maybe we don't. Maybe the surge is funding. It's okay. And it's got power to it?
Yeah. Oh, no, it wasn't quite all the way in. There we go.
James is still print.
Leonard, do you have anything else to add about our amendments, or?
Good comment. This is a huge chapter.
Yeah, nothing that we kind of haven't hit on before. It started off as very minor amendments, and that kind of makes sense. I see that. can always take an SMP and delete it in large section of it, and then instead refer it into the critical areas ordinance, which is almost identical. What I've been struggling with is figuring out how identical or conversely how different they are.
Mm-hmm.
I think from what I've seen, they look really close, right? You know, the wetlands is the wetlands, but the strike through and edit is very confusing. So trying to compare the old versus the new. It's confusing. We've talked about this before.
Yeah.
And then also maybe the timing, maybe I've forgotten what we came up with, but in the shoreline world, when we make changes to the SMP, it'll have to be approved by ecology.
Mm-hmm.
We can't approve a reference inside the SMP. That reference points to a CAO if it's not completed. So we got to get that CAO stuff done first before we get sucked into the SMP. Clear there that
for ecology's review.
Correct.
Yeah.
So it's an order of a time.
Right. Yeah. And I'm hoping that'll go to council. Like I said, I'm working on the ordinance, so in February. So it should still give us enough time.
The CIO that's done.
Right.
That's
correct.
With that, I don't see any fatal flaws. Started out as very simple, minor amendments.
It's kind of an administrative mess, yeah.
But I commend the city for trying to integrate CAO and SMP so it's the same language. It just makes sense. Mm-hmm. I've been a planner and written thousands of permits. When you have different ordinances that say almost the same thing, it's very good.
So that's probably how I could explain why they bought property on the other side of the shoreline many years ago. My Redventon Mall was built in 68. It's clear to me that they were anticipating the Shoreline Act in 72. But they built the mall all the way down along both roundways. So we have an advantage that most people don't have because we have sort of like twisting shoreline. And it falls down, stays down. We don't try to clear it out. We don't try to be very respectful of the importance of dead and down with all the shorelines and anything else. So we don't try to make a garden spot out of it. But I do appreciate when kayakers come and they pull off because it's a very slow flowing part where our beach is and they can practice with kayak clubs coming to practice their kayaking turns and things on the beach. I actually welcome that. They're very respectful about it. I don't want somebody walking down my driveway with this fishing tackle and waiting for someone with the things that go in through my river, through my yard.
And that's not the intent of the regulation.
I don't care what you're saying, but that's the way it reads. Mark. It reads that the owners of shoreline need to provide for the access of the public to the shore.
For new development,
right.
And also when consistent with the parks element. So the parks element provides a trail plan map which shows trails in certain locations, primarily on the levees where access is desired. Not all areas of the levees, just areas of the levees that are reasonably feasible to do and don't create impacts, such as in the old Sideview neighborhood. That's not proposed for public access because those are a whole lot of established backyards. It's not shown up Tanner Road at all because there's no levee, there's no purpose for public access along those, and there's also designated public access spots, such as the kayak takeout place there.
But people go into the designated, like the old right-of-way that where the bridge was. They access the river, they go down the river, and at that point, they can pull out if they want to. They can pull out on my property, and then you place the property down the river. That's the way it's written.
But isn't it that anything below the ordinary watermark is public property?
I don't know. Let Leonard respond to.
I mean, they get into those battles in California,
right?
Big time.
And this area, the public trust doctrine says just that. In essence, anything below an area is open to the public.
And I noticed I live upstream of Dick, and it really only happens when the water's super low, and people see all the rocks, and they get out. And when the water's high, they don't mess with it. But when it's low, they can actually wade across from the point that you're talking about. So I don't know if there's anything you can do about that. I look at it like there have been people that have been drinking and someone like threw up because they were so drunk. I mean, so there's some ridiculous stuff that happens, but if they're just, I guess, on the beach, then I mean, if you called the cops, if they knew the law, they'd probably say there's nothing we can do here. I mean, unless they're actually under the law.
Yeah, if they're coming through from the street through your yard to access,
yeah.
That's private property.
Yeah,
they shouldn't
this
be doing
does
that.
Not require that. Yeah. So this is talking about new developments, subdivisions. Where they're providing a substantial number of lots at an access point to the river would be required.
If there's a specific language,
I've read a lot of notes. I went through the first 50 pages, five. We had a couple of technical notes about something, the forestry, but the one that drove me a lot was I just want to comment about public access off the original shoreline. If I invited this company, they're not allowed to show up to me to start a night on the beach. It's not going to happen. And they shouldn't, I don't think anybody would do that to increase these codes. They just do it. But I don't want them to have a basis of formality. That's the lesson of it. It's in here. It's clear. If they want to pull off on the beach, this code allows that to happen.
Respectfully, it does not. It does not apply at all retroactively to existing properties that are already developed. It only applies to new development and in certain circumstances when consistent with the trail plan map of the comprehensive plan, which only shows certain areas, not broadly across all shorelines.
I'm wondering whether, if you just look at 1420, 320A. This whole section, 1420, 320 is public access. And
right.
I'm not going to read the whole thing.
I can pull it up
quite
right
a bit,
here.
But can it be made? Can you clarify that this only applies for new development and you have to define a new development instead of whether it's new substantial development or something that might help? And it might already be in there, and I'm just not having focused on this with all the unchanged language, I'm not sure. Okay, I actually see under C.
The applicability section is 1420-120, page 3. And
clarification there.
And we can just add in right under 142320 the first non-redline sentence, applicants for new development required to provide shoreline public access.
And it gets added in B where it says exceptions for shoreline substantial developments and shoreline conditional uses. So these are new permits. So it says it, but not as clear as it should. It's certainly the case. It's not right.
Oh, I know.
But Dave, I think that might help when you're help clarify what you're concerned about.
As I read this, there's an overarching philosophy of the shorelines, the water's edge, is public property.
And that's really the Shoreline Management Act.
To be clear, yes, there's three fundamental tenets of the Act itself. It's protecting shorelines for appropriate development, industry, water-related stuff, residential uses. It's also protecting the shorelines and their ecological functionality, the fish and the birds and the bunnies. So those two are kind of in conflict with each other, so we're charged with balancing those. And that third tenet, the third leg of the stool, if you will, is public access. It's a big deal, by design. Right. With that said, this is a SMP, it's regulations, but this process we're going through is a comprehensive planning effort. So we're trying to outline our preferred future, what we want to see. And I think in a general sense, as people that live in a town and work for the town, public access is a good thing, as long as it's provided by the public. So we want to encourage public access when we can. But to be sure, this, as written, does not affect your property.
And the intent is not public access across all property. It's in certain locations.
It's finding good places to put people, because as population grows in a city like this, we see it like Tri-Cities, the Yakima, the Columbia, you know, high-density spot in the middle of the desert. And shoreline property owners all feel just like you do.
I'm not alone. I know that. But we get places like the Main Stems of Quality in their Falls City, where they're just rafting that entire river off, crapping in the water, doing whatever they want to do. That's not right. Mm-hmm. That's not what you want. That's not following any code. That's letting the code run amok. Mm-hmm. And that could happen anywhere on the North Fork. Anywhere. Yeah? And that's not going to happen where I live. Almost going
to
happen.
Which is where the code tries to contemplate the future and funneling people into public places where there are facilities and garbage cans and boat ramps and stuff. So it's not a free-for-all of private property, because if people look into the river, they statewide, they've proven that.
Yeah. Well, public access isn't required for a single-family home. So that's on page 36. C1.
What happens so is that this document provides cover for it to happen anywhere along the river. And then it's if you're on the water, you can pull through wherever you want. Certainly, if you have a safety issue, anyways, it's totally reasonable to pull over onto a non-public land and set up camp.
So there's two different streams of regulation here. This is a development regulation applying to what happens when somebody wants to develop their property. I think what you're talking about is more just a general use and behavior regulation of trespass. So that's not addressed here at all. And you have the right to limit anybody off of your property that you don't want on your property. And you could post signage, et cetera, to prevent that from happening. But that's not something that this would address. That's police power.
But this requires me to hire one or two plaintiff's attorneys to be ready to take on a case that will with me, because people who read this like I do say this is the line of law that would be under property. Sue me. And they'll take a stand. And this isn't clear that this is a development document. It reads like this is a public law that allows access all the shore lines. That's what we start reading. They don't say, well, this is all for developer and developers of Hillside. These are things you have to expect from these things, which you have to follow. It describes public behavior in the limits of shoreline. It says very clearly that public, once you're on the water, can pull off the water onto the shoreline. Now, if you're how you try to word it, Mark, it's just that's the way it is, and that's where people read it. And I haven't had any problem with this. This is the first time in 4 years I've sat on this commission that I've had a chance to voice my concern about this issue. We have some, almost all the users except the river runs low. That's when you get the party rafts coming down. They act differently, but most kayakers are absolutely serious about their sport, and they're looking on the river. They're not looking for anything. The rafting clubs are coming in and training young people to how to roll on things. They find our beach useful because it's still water and they can take them out and do it safely. I love that. I'm not trying to stop that. What I'm saying is, this is an invitation to use my land for other purposes other than a water purpose. Because somehow they have a right to look outside from where they sit.
Well, I don't know if this helps, if anything can be helped right now, but just at the very beginning, looking at the applicability on just page 2, it talks about all proposed uses, which I think your staff was talking about. This one thing relates to new development, not existing. But it talks about all proposed uses, activities, or developments. So I guess proposed uses, proposed activities, or proposed development. I think that's what it means, not existing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Is that where, just trying to find somewhere where it said what you're referring to.
Yeah, existing is considered a legal non-conforming use. So this does not apply retroactively to development. Only if somebody were to come in to do development of their property to change what's there now.
Then, you look at those factors.
And a public access is just that. There has to be an easement provided, a dedication of land provided through development donation or something.
My prior career at Weyerhaeuser, we had people trespassing on Weyerhaeuser in ways you could ever imagine. And it becomes an established use. Deer trails become hiking trails. When Weyerhaeuser comes to log a piece of land, confrontations with hiking groups saying you can't walk across our trail, and that happens near the corner of this county. Every county has these established trails. They're not public, but they've been used by trespass. And all of a sudden, they become a use. Now the owner has to confront and justify it and carry it out. So that established use is nonsense. This is in a document somewhere that shows ownership. You can't just say a trail's been used there for an official trail. But time and time again, in my line of work, I defend our right to take that trail out against very established clubs. Credible clubs. Harvey Manning was legendary for that. Get boots on the ground, make a trail, then you can defend it. And so the landowner is always defending themselves against these established use trails that have been used for years without permission. So I think it's wrong to use the term established trail as a legal basis for developing a trail. I have a chance to talk about the formal setting because it happens for the landowners everywhere in this county, particularly as you push further and further east into the woods. Established by fishermen who are trying to find a shortcut to the river over time and makes the trail.
Move on a little bit.
Yeah,
okay. That's all right. simple change. I just had something I was curious of when I was looking at comparing the online version.
Mm-hmm.
I think it probably says 66 pages in their total, James. At least that's what mine had, and then this one has 74, so it's getting a little thrown off by that. I don't know if it's
74.
That one's at 74. Yeah, for some reason when I was looking at it, it's 66, so maybe it was, maybe that is a non-issue.
Sometimes the track changes, it bumps things around.
Yeah, I didn't see anything totally different, but when I was just trying to reference pages.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that would have been useful for me would have been this map, because I still have questions. I got really confused and hung up on this table that's in here. It's kind of like the, seems like the meat of this thing to me. I forgot what page it's on. There's a table of allowed uses, and it references these designations,
right.
And I was kind of reading about them, and I didn't know where they were, and how they were, what page?
28. Okay. No, it's impervious.
Page 24.
Okay, I have it here. Yeah, so I think I can't really zoom into that now to see what's where, but I was just kind of going through there, and I think Leonard might have just commented on one of the purposes of the Shoreline Management Act was for development. You use that word?
I don't remember.
Okay. Well, when I look at purpose, though, on page 4, I don't think I see development in there. It talks about recreational opportunities and public and natural systems preserve, ecological functions, and maybe it's in there somewhere with development, but where I'm going with it is there is a lot of allowed development in the shoreline, which I didn't really understand that. That kind of confused me why we would allow so much development. Because to me, when I read it, there's a lot allowed in kind of a small area. It's like, why can't we protect the shoreline better? I mean, you're talking about new development. You're not talking about going back and taking things out or charging people. I mean, these are things that we have the ability, areas we have the ability to protect.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wasn't sure where the natural one was, but that's what I clued in on. That's like a pristine
area. Yeah, you can kind of see
area.
It's blurry to me. But,
a lot has X's, which actually that's one change I would recommend is that on page 23, maybe make sure to, you have permitted uses, conditional uses, prohibited,
mm-hmm.
and then you went to P, C, and X, and so X is prohibited, I believe, but it's not described
mm-hmm.
anywhere that I saw.
Okay.
So just say right in permitted is P, conditional C, and prohibited is X.
Yeah. Clarification.
So using natural as an example,
right.
I got kind of hung up on the last third page of the table, page 26, and I got a little confused with the shoreline residential designation,
mm-hmm.
and then there's there's a shoreline residential designation, and then there's a use of residential development, and so shoreline residential development is allowed in the shoreline residential,
mm-hmm.
which probably makes sense, I suppose, if it's written that way, and then under natural, it's conditional. So things like that on a natural, pristine habitat, it's from what I read, natural description. Why would we allow residential development? I'm just not sure the thinking behind that.
As a conditional?
I think a lot of it would relate to the ownership of the property, if it's privately owned, not allowing a residential development. That's kind of one of the most basic fundamental uses that would prohibit takings. If you were to not allow a single family home on a piece of property,
mm-hmm.
that's considered a taking.
If so that's all they own, if that's all the parcel.
Yeah.
And it wasn't feasible to develop it outside of the shoreline.
I can see that, but that's an exception. And I wonder if we, just the thinking of it, like let's say it's much bigger, it goes out 5 acres or so, and there's plenty of room for residential development. And it's just about the purpose would be to actually save that shoreline. Because we're talking about, what we're talking about is a small area, right? 200 feet.
That's been our conditional use permit.
Okay.
conditional use as a last resort permit.
Okay.
Difficult to approve locally, and they get sent to ecology for final approval, and we'd probably deny something that brief itself.
Okay.
Even though...
It's a good example of that balance between protecting shorelines for development and from development. It's tough, and that's what you guys are doing.
Even if there was not a spot to put the home outside of shoreline, would you deny a permit?
We'd have to look at the specific.
Yeah, because then you might get into the takings.
If you were to look at
the
criteria for approval of a conditional use permit,
right.
They're very difficult to make.
Right.
Okay.
It seems that in our codes we have an after shoreline, and we cannot permit development. That shows up, you know, in the records. So when you go to file for a permit or buy a property, you're notified right away that the next part of your land is not developed when you buy it, knowing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I support that.
Mm-hmm.
I support that. But if it's a natural area, there's limitations to what you can do, both in terms of recreational, residential, even harvesting. Harvesting is limited in natural environment. People know that. When you buy land, you find that out right away because you want to buy this land with the idea of building a home. All of a sudden, you find out before you sign the deed, it's restricted. Can't build a house with a 200 feet of that shoreline. It's not taking. Taking for not a form, but it's not taking legally. So, you take that seriously. Because I think the shorelines are critical.
I had just clarification on that. It's the shoreline environmental designation, still staying on that topic. Are those state determined, or did the city come up with these? I just don't know.
The description of what those are?
Yeah, where did that come from?
It comes out of the Shoreline Management Act, but then the local jurisdiction can tailor those designations to site circumstances.
Okay. Well, can you explain more the shoreline residential designation? I just trying to understand.
Yeah, 1420 to 40 is where that description is. I just want, or do you guys have that page? I'm on
42.
Okay, mine's showing up on 21, so a little bit different. But that's basically a LDR zone. It's or a overlay. So it's planned for residential.
So
predominantly single family or multifamily.
And so it overlaps with.
Correct. Yeah.
The zoning, city zoning.
Right. So that's what we did when we established these designations: is looking at the zonings. You know, commercial conservancy. I think is one that's going to overlap with a commercial downtown commercial zone. Natural is going to overlap with parks, open space.
Yeah, that
yeah.
Explains
a lot.
Yeah.
Exactly analogous to
zones. Yeah.
Right.
Shoreline zoning. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Urban, let's see, I'd have to look up the description. Urban conservancy residential is a little bit different from commercial conservancy, urban conservancy. So that provides a different level of protection. So kind of a step down from natural, then you go to urban conservancy, and urban residential is a part of that. So it allows some of those uses, but it provides that shoreline ecological functions are a priority. You know, you're not impacting. And again, there are no changes really to that portion that we've been talking about.
Question, and I might be preaching far here, but as far as if a homeless encampment were to just show up Mm-hmm. I mean,
I'm not laughing at you. The subject in general has been talked about.
It's a tough conversation.
It's a tough conversation. It's, in any way, it's not a shoreline conversation, but there is some overlap.
Yeah.
I live in Yakima. We have the Greenway, so the freeway, and then a Greenway, a trail, a lot of riparian area for many miles. And that, of course, is where our homeless people live. And it's a mess with no easy solutions, but it's so much better than just regulating shorelines.
Mm-hmm.
Spokane's having a hard time with all the wet stuff. So not to cut you off on your question, but there's no easy answer. Here.
And there's probably nothing specific in the shoreline code, like you said.
And probably shouldn't be.
Right.
Yeah. Protection standards for vegetation conservation.
Right.
Don't cut down the riparian areas.
Right.
Enforcing it becomes problematic, especially when it's homeless people that perhaps don't follow that as well. If you guys find a good solution, this is a conversation we've been having repeatedly at policy level statewide.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I had a question on the shoreline vegetation conservation, page 30. Talks about vegetation clearing, and the most desirable vegetation to retain would be native significant trees.
Mm-hmm.
And then non-native significant trees, native and non-native non-significant trees, and other native vegetation. So is the purpose of non-native significant trees for structure within the floodplain or floodway? Otherwise, an invasive tree would...
Maybe not invasive, but...
Yeah,
an example might be just a very large beech tree.
Mm-hmm.
It still is providing shading and stability to that shoreline, shading to the water.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's not a native species, it's providing some benefit. If it's invasive, that may be a different story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that was why. All right. Scott, would you have something?
No, so I only looked at the track changes portions. I haven't looked at the rest of the codes to get that out there. But I had a few questions for Jamie, and she answered yesterday, and I have no other comments.
I can say this, that my problem is I'm always reminded by my mentors that once you open up a document, the revisions, the whole document, so and I tend to drag this commission down into that water of nothing's being changed, but I'm playing about what exists, but it's there. So I get a chance to get my oil in the water when I did my first this was first pass. In terms of the changes, I think they're fine. I'm fine with the changes. It's the overall reading of this document that gets me in the back before. I'm not going to change it. I'm just saying to you that the document deals too heavily on private property rights when it comes to shoreline, that really narrow space between the water's edge. I'm not agreeing to something. I think put also on my side. But in here, anybody can use it for defense for themselves. It just causes a problem. Even though I understand in my professional life the idea about environmental protection, you know, the area that's fastly growing and it's outstripping the protections we have, we need to find ways to protect it. This document is doing it, but it's also doing it changes that would be proposed in this large document are suitable.
Yeah, and as a point of order, you know, like Leonard said, I'm hopefully bringing forward February 22nd, I think it is, the critical area amendments. That's a huge load of work that you guys did to council. And then the deadline for this is June 30th still? Yeah.
Very strict.
Thereabouts. And so ecology will probably have some comments, and there'll be some changes made, but I think we are, you know, you guys have a lot of work to do this year. It's scary, your schedule. So if they're, you know, I don't know if you're ready to make a recommendation tonight. That's up to you. But if there's changes that come out of review comments and whatnot, I can let you know or bring those back. But I think the essence of what you're approving, you're seeing the track changes and kind of the scope of the amendments that we're needing to make. And again, the bulk of the work was really with the critical areas. So we'll still be working on this and finessing it and finalizing it for the next few months. But the critical components are here, so.
This is the change, but it's a mistake, I think, back on page 51. Just talking about the paragraph 4, we're talking about satellite fishing. Anywhere upstream of the falls is a present. So why did we mention it? But we mentioned it because it's part of a large document we included. But it's not really dealing with reality in our neighborhood. We don't have satellites in this
one. Which section are you looking at?
Page 51 of 74, paragraph 4, and about third down.
In-stream structures.
Just some boilerplate language from the state.
Yeah,
left over. Although trout and whitefish.
Right, so the definition there, it does include cutthroat, brook, brown, rainbow, steelhead, kokanee, bull trout. That's all I'm learning, okay.
But yeah, that's just plug and chug.
Mm-hmm.
The in-stream structures on previous on page 15, that on the page we're talking about in-stream structures, hydro generation. There's no mention about small hydro. This paragraph really is focusing on dams,
mm-hmm.
large amounts. But in-stream, I think about small hydro. Especially if you use the word stream, if you use the word river, maybe you're talking about, you know, large dam. Small hydro, like with Chris Ketcher, he's there with him. But it talks about hydro generation in a way that seems like it's not a good thing. But we already have four or five of these up on the North Fork and the South Fork. They're not doing anything to impact fish or water quality.
And this does allow in-stream structures as long as it's meeting the criteria within that section.
Yeah, but I like to see the mention of small hydro along with large hydro. In other words, it just talks about hydro record dams.
The intent here is to catch everything that could possibly be in the stream.
I know.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think it does that. It does mention hydro, but it could be a small check down. to your point, we could.
But to the reader, I don't see it in here.
It does say engineering structures may include that means that list, so it's not all inclusive.
Because I would certainly be promoting small hydro anywhere in this valley. It's fish safe. It's inexpensive. I got 3 million dollar warehouse property 20 years ago. I did a good job. Got right here in the south front from Wally Park. You see that? Small hydro right across the south.
Did we go closer on that? Okay. I'd like to go back to the significant tree. I guess go to the definition. It was on page 16. It's kind of referencing what I was mentioning before, but it talks about significant tree on number 127. Mm-hmm. It says it means any evergreen tree other than holly of at least 15 inches. Its diameter and standard height is the new DBH. Mm-hmm. And any deciduous tree other than poplar at 12 inches. So the poplar part, I think that like willow, cottonwood, and alder would be considered poplar. So in a river system, those are actually desirable. So the poplar, I think, is related to probably upland residential development where you wouldn't want cottonwood and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. I don't think we want it to say this because we want cottonwood, alder, and willow to be in a river system. So
I'm not sure what the context of these particular regulations for significant tree are. But
significant tree, the context goes back to page 30. Mm-hmm. And that's where it talks about vegetation clearing and what is most desirable to retain. So it is desirable to retain what is called an invasive tree here.
Cottonwood, alder, and poplar.
Yeah, those aren't invasive trees. So it's, I don't know if this, hopefully this isn't state language.
No, so on page 30 or where the tree reference shows up, remember,
yeah, I got to make sure it's. I'm reading the
that it's matching, because our new tree regulations, we changed the definition of what a significant tree is, but we should check the species and make sure, you know, are there things that we don't care if they're in a shoreline environment, but for clearing purposes or development purposes outside, we don't want.
And this like section. Section D there talks about what is most desirable to mm-hmm. save. So native significant. And I think I'm getting hung up by the when I go back to the definition of what significant mm-hmm. is, they're saying, I mean, poplar is a pretty generic term that is kind of used by a non-scientist. It doesn't describe anything specifically. Mm-hmm. It isn't helpful, really.
This is also outside of buffers, though. So the first premise is that you've got a stream buffer, and within that stream buffer, you're protecting all vegetation. And so outside of that buffer is your developable area, and within that developable area, that's where it's describing that the significant native versus non-native trees in terms of prioritization.
I think we can clean up that definition, though, and make sure it's consistent with the tree code that we're referencing in 1910 and make sure it's getting at what we want for shorelines. So I can work on that piece with ecology and our consultant.
Take a look at that. I think part of what Mike said is I do see in here as far as invasive trees are not considered significant, so I do see that written there.
Right.
But let's just make sure that those deciduous riparian species are not accidentally, I don't think it's intentional, but just accidentally labeled as.
Right. guys are going to go. Can't do that.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want a motion?
Are you feeling all right with this, Mr. Ryan?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. That's his.
I recommend approval of proposed shoreline regulations from January 3rd, 2019.
I'll second.
North Bend Municipal Code 14.20 shoreline regulations.
Sure. That one too. Yeah.
Good.
As amended.
As amended.
Second by Mr. Bogers.
Oh, you second?
Yeah.
I heard him.
No other comments or changes? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Not opposed? Motion
Thank
carries.
You. Like I said, I'll send it to you again once we get the final. Come on.
Yeah, that was a pretty big one there.
Yeah, you must have had a lot of fun with Roland and Mercer Island. Just there.
We had good shoreline regulations. Mm. Burien was more of a challenge. Mm. We had adopted three counties and never changed them.
Mm.
So we were dealing with very, very, very old regulations. Mm. Quite controversial.
Are you going to drive over the pass line?
That's easy. I was up in Wenatchee earlier today. I was there yesterday.
Oh, boy.
So I had to go going home. And
for medium density residential zone.
So it's actually amazing. It's been a full 12 months since this was initially generated when the council had a retreat. They're having a retreat coming up next week. But 12 months since they gave this direction, and just still plugging away through the zoning amendments that they gave direction on. So coming to you with the medium density residential idea. And tonight, I'm just looking for some initial feedback. We're not actually bringing this to you as an agenda item yet. We'll bring that probably in March. But what I need right now from you is just an overall idea of where this should be so that we can notify those property owners about the process and some overall criteria about the types of uses and densities that we're looking for with this. I was going to bring this up on the screen. Oh. But I can see where I want to start. Well, you got it on your packet, so let's go ahead and go forward. So if we start out, take a look at this map right here. And this is, again, from that council retreat from last year. And what I did is I just bubbled the zoning amendments relating to this medium density residential. And the council's overall intent for this was that this would be a transition between what we have in our high density residential zone, which is typical multifamily, and our single family zone. We've got the cottages right now, but that's a very specific product in some specific areas, and this was intended to broaden that out a little bit, particularly surrounding the downtown core where we wanted to see additional development. Right now, we just have that kind of harsh transition between multifamily and conventional single family. So the three primary areas that we have for this, and I think, Scott, you'd ask for a little bit more detail on the site context of these areas. So I provided some aerials. We didn't have GIS layers that we thought would be really useful for this. So the aerial is probably showing you what you're looking for with regard to existing development patterns. So just starting out, the first area to look at is that area on North Bend Way to Cedar Falls Way, just east of the roundabout. Right now, it's characterized by predominantly single-family, low-density single-family, but also with a lot of potential being adjacent, directly adjacent to downtown and adjacent to other multifamily areas. So that we've got the John Day Orchard Place apartments going in at the corner there. We've got Torgerson Park just immediately to the north, where that would likely be a suitable site for multifamily use or other higher density residential. And then the context of being between two major arterials, Cedar Falls Way and North Bend Way, making it not as suitable for conventional single-family development. We've had a number of docket requests in the past to rezone this property, or this general area. The Planning Commission in the past has recommended approval of that, and at that time it was to change it to multifamily development, or to multifamily zoning. That got all the way to the council, and because of some public comment, the council was receptive to that comment. It was concerned about that, and from what I recall from that, it was the concern was more about the idea of conventional multifamily being too dense for this area. So that's where this medium-density residential approach might work well in that context. The next area to show you on the next map, which is just immediately north of the downtown commercial zone, transitioning to the Silver Creek neighborhood. So if you look at that second map, the library is just at the southern part of the map there on Main Avenue, and that's where you're then crossing the Snoqualmie Valley Trail, which would form the southern boundary of this new MDR zone. That area is currently zoned single family, but again, it's at a higher density level of single family that's more similar to what's in the downtown commercial zone, the single family development patterns there. And there are a few multifamily uses within that area. There's some duplexes, maybe even a fourplex in there on 6th Street. And there is, okay, yeah. So there is some context of potential for transition. The council would recommend looking at this area, and staff concurs that this would be a nice transition between that higher density with the downtown commercial and the Silver Creek neighborhood. The third one to look at is currently zoned cottage residential, actually, but because of the size of it, it's a very large property. I think it's close to 40 acres. Something around 40 acres, but it's very large. If you imagine all cottages within that very large site, that would be somewhat monotonous. And so an idea is to transition this instead to a medium density residential and allow other typologies, duplex, triplex, cottage, other things that could be allowed, would give it more diversity and make it more of a vibrant neighborhood. So wanted to first get your feedback. Do you concur with those areas? Are there other areas that you feel should also be included? And we'll make notification to the property owners within those areas accordingly of potential for amendment. Right here, so downtown commercial zone.
Okay.
If you look throughout this whole area, this neighborhood all the way over to QFC, it's predominantly single-family homes, but it could transition at any time to commercial uses.
Thank you, Mark. So, and the one that's right in this next town over, so long, it's exactly what we're talking about. I keep forgetting the name of that little neighborhood there across the fire station.
Oh, yeah, so Dick actually provided this to me to hand out. This would be an example of what a medium-density residential neighborhood could look like. This is the Kimble Creek Village across from the fire station.
Yeah.
And that's got a mix. That's actually...
It's actually a little daycare.
Just
there.
A little community for pickup stuff. And it's got duplexes side-by-side attached, single-family, close.
So yeah, that's an excellent example of showing the compatibility of some of these higher density typologies with single family. It provides that transition.
So if I can say on that second page, there's a piece of property that I want to angle space that I could see of right now that would be a possibility for some level of something interesting.
Which one, Mary?
Right at the end of 6th Street. That would be the triangle. Other than that, you're looking at all these established homes that may, you know, so we can sell at some point and break that into duplex or triplex. Across the street at 120, that's my old home. Was sold a few years ago. Now you can, I was hoping at some point to subdivide that property. Now, if we do that, you can do that. You know, this is leverage.
Everything.
Your dreams almost came true.
Seriously, but anyway, I find some irony here, and also I know that area well. I've lived there for 14, almost 13 years now. And once you have an established little funky neighborhood, I'll just say it's funky. Mm-hmm. There have been changes. I've seen it come from really sketchy to better.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not opposed to it, but it's going to be tricky to pull it off with a...
And that's exactly what I also provided the materials on. It's called the missing middle in the website. And I was hoping to bring that up on the screen too, just to show you, because the copies are not very clear. But the whole idea of a medium density residential zone and this missing middle in particular are typologies that are within the same bulk as a conventional single-family home. So you could have up to 4 units in what looks like a conventional single-family home. It's got a porch. It's got kind of ground floor detailing like a single-family home, even if it has multiple units within it. And in that case, you could plunk it in with a conventional single-family neighborhood, and it doesn't look out of context. So that's, I think, the direction that I'm recommending that I'd like to hear back from you on, if you concur with that, that we then pursue this zone.
So an infill, in a lot of cases, it's going to be just infill. It's going to happen a couple times here and a couple times there, and then like the AF Evans site, it could potentially be a new development
pattern. Can I ask a question about tiny homes? Are people coming and asking about that? So that's still in the area. We still really don't have it in place.
We have accessory dwelling units. That's the equivalent, but on as a standalone.
So again, affordability.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that the Kimble Creek development, one of the keys is narrow streets. Mm. They're abnormally narrow compared to what we normally have.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, I think we're almost treated like one-way streets. They seem to park one way. Just, you know, when you go in there, you find out that they just drive in a circle.
It's a kind of a closed loop.
It's kind of,
yeah.
And I just happened to be going here for some physical therapy at that training center.
Mm-hmm.
That's always busy. Always busy. Mm-hmm. That little subway out there, always busy. Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to say is, when I talk to my therapist who lives in that community, they love it.
Mm-hmm.
They walk to work. Mm-hmm. They walk in the neighborhood. It's strictly a walking around neighborhood feel. But it's small, and it's unified.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to get that from an established community that's maybe on the downward side of livability. I noticed that there's a lot of streets we have in town that really are hard, scrabble properties. I realize that. We could find a way to bring them together. And one of those ways that I've noticed is if you look at the last slide I had on my little packet, I'm going up the road a bit. I've come across the Habitat for Humanity of Wyron Tarkhead, one of those communities that I have in Alberta. But Habitat for Humanity has sprung a whole, it's the last page. Mm-hmm. And Habitat for Humanity is right here. This is mm-hmm. this is where they are. And then there's another community very closely developed. And you notice in the Habitat for Humanity development, they have the garages on the street, but with an interior walkway. Mm-hmm. And that makes that community just very livable because you're walking, knocking on your neighbor's door across the street. And so you really feel connected physically to a lot of your neighbors mm-hmm. by that sensible design. Is to get people walking across between the houses I have and across the street. But I think those kind of details in an MR make this a dream zone. I really do. Mm-hmm. And I think we should find a way to make it happen in our town. Because when I hear about streets like this, where they're not looking outside where they're living. You know, they like to look inside and live where they live. And they like their neighbors. They like the corner barbershop, whatever. And they're not looking to drive 5 miles to get a haircut. Mm-hmm. It's right there.
Yeah. And these areas that you see are right around the downtown core. So they would have that opportunity.
For that's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. That's where it belongs, right around the downtown core. All these outward densities. It's a perfect match. I think it'll liven up the downtown business for sure.
Yeah, I just say that I lived in Seattle for about 5 years and lived in this, I guess, was a stacked triplex. That was pretty cool. It just looked like an old maybe Craftsman house or something like that. We lived on the top floor, and you went in the house and then went up some stairs to get the second one. We were around the back and took stairs all the way up to the top. But it was very affordable in the Wallingford neighborhood. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to live there. So I definitely like the concept of this, and I think it is missing in our area. On the locations, what I like is keeping it closer to the downtown core. At first, I wasn't sure about the second area there, which is like the 5th and 6th Street right in town. But I think, as you described it, there's already a few mixed living situations. And it's where we want it because there's already smaller lots, and we want more of the density there. When this came through the Planning Commission in a docket process, I think some of the Planning Commission agreed on like the spot that's the first aerial there. It's in between North Bend Way and Cedar Falls. I don't like that location. I guess I have two concerns. Is it's creating this higher density, because at the time it was proposed HDR, this MDR now, to be less dense, but these are some larger rural lots that I think, while I know there's a need for MDR, I don't want to just create density just to create it or to try to make things more affordable. I don't think that's a good solution to just create more dense housing, and I get concerned about moving it further outside. I know that's not far, too far away, but it's not within the downtown core.
If I can offer one reason for doing this, we just had a pre-application review for one of those lots for a single-family home. The people were interested to do a single-family home. But because of North Bend Way frontage, first of all, because of the proximity to downtown, the price was higher than what it would be further out.
And the then land, also the land price, value, yeah.
And then also because of the North Bend Way frontage there, which would also apply on Cedar Falls Way, your frontage improvements are going to be a lot more costly because it's an arterial, and so you're doing wider sidewalks, bigger planter strip, street trees, undergrounding utilities, and other things that then drive that price up substantially more than what it would be in a more conventional single-family area. So that's another reason for transition, is to reflect the higher and best, highest and best reality, market-driven use of the site because of its proximity to the downtown.
Because it would be costly to redo.
You get more out of the duplexer.
What's the acreage on this?
On the area, the hole there?
30?
Yeah.
I think about that, yeah.
And where's the City Hall property? Is that on this?
Further to the east, so you can see the fire station's right here. Okay. City Hall would just sit right about
there. I was driving through there, all the time, but I got this map, and I got totally turned around because I didn't see that. I was looking for Thrasher, didn't go up to 424.
Yeah.
Because I'm driving it, so I got all turned around.
And then a question that I had also, if you choose to recommend this area, is the council had said go up Thrasher as well with those single-family homes. I personally don't recommend that because it suddenly takes on a little bit of a different character. You've got a row of 1960s and 70s ranch houses there, and you're transitioning away from that core. So to me, that seems more conventional single-family residential. The council has suggested including that initially, so.
It would leave you with a small strip of.
It would, which is a little odd.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering here.
Well, on the one map, it's separated as two sections, and on the aerial, it's you've included the homes on the north side a little bit. Yeah. I don't know. I think what's easier for me is. I guess they're numbered. So on the map, number 6 seems easier to me. 7 and 8 a little harder. Number 9 is the cottage residential, and that seems easier to approve the location too, just because it's there's nothing there. I think it. I don't know how it's turned out ultimately. We were up in Bellingham. I think last summer, and they have a trail there. I don't know what the name of it is, but it's along a waterway, and there were a bunch of homes along there, and I think it's a great opportunity for people to use the trail ultimately. That big open space is actually private property there, right? It kind of makes it almost seems like it's Tanner Landing Park there when I look at it sometimes.
So. It's interesting. I wondered if this was allowed, if commercial on number 9, on the south side of 9, that would evolve into more of a, less of a automobile type commercial, into more of a residential.
A neighborhood.
Commercial.
Yeah.
And if that were to happen, putting the NDR in there, where nothing's there, and creating a whole new community, using this as the commercial already next to it would be a slam dunk.
Yeah, that would be an interesting scenario using both of those.
The issue is access. We'd have to find a second way out of there. You're not going to control the access with just one exit.
Well, that's exactly what Kimball Creek has, right? Just one access.
Fire Department will have.
They would connect it over there with. The ranger station cottages. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that would become connected to those newer homes right to the west of it. That probably wasn't for sale about 15 years ago. Dixon had it up on the market for 3 separate apartment complexes. Couldn't get funded. Rather than that.
But that makes sense for 55 and above, some sort of. For that to happen. You're still getting closer to town, walkability, but we don't seem to have any of that happening right now. As far as that.
There's definitely interest, but no projects yet.
I'll weigh in quickly. So the Silver Creek one, I wasn't sure about it when I came to the meeting, but hearing some of the reasons, I think it may make sense. I kind of take a longer-term view of zoning changes, mm-hmm. so I'm trying to think. It's not going to happen overnight,
right.
and it is going to continue, I think, to be a funky neighborhood, to use your term, in that you're going to see houses that people will just stay there for many years while things change around them. But I think overall, I think it's a good way to get some density right next to the downtown core without impinging on the rest of the Silver Creek neighborhood. I know there's already rumors around the neighborhood of the city's going to come in and rezone the entire neighborhood to build duplexes and triplexes. So mm-hmm. that's already out there. For seven and eight, I think I'm okay with the changes there, including going up toward the ranger station cottages.
Okay.
Only because I just think it's hard for me to see this little tiny strip of, I'll just call single family, mm-hmm. right there next to the cottages and the medium density.
Yeah.
It just makes sense to kind of make that nice and clean. I can take that or leave it, but I think it makes sense to make it nice and clean. I think it's still close enough to be walkable to downtown mm-hmm. there. The larger property, number 9, I actually have a little bit more problem with because I think that we're starting to get on the outside of the walkability scale there.
Mm-hmm.
I do understand that and can appreciate if it's 40 acres of cottages, we're not going to like what that looks like. And I don't think it's going to make a really good neighborhood. But
within the cottage zone, you still can do conventional single family mixed
yeah,
in.
Okay.
But what this idea would be to just open it up a little broader as well.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. I think maybe I'm supporting it in a roundabout way, which is, I think for me it depends on the design standards. You know, as we get more into what are the typologies that are allowed, how does that 40 acres have to be designed? And you might be able to get a little bit more specific and regulatory with 40 acres where you can't do that in the Silver Creek area. You can't require the Silver Creek property to have, you know, paths through the backyards
yeah.
or anything like that because there's just so many individual ownerships where you could with 40 acres.
Mm.
So I think I might support it with more design focus on the 40 acres.
Okay. Keep in mind we've got that trail
mm-hmm.
right on the edge of that, which makes it very likable for people who live in an MDR community.
Yeah.
They have their bikes out there all the time.
That's true.
Yeah, what do you think about that? Mary brought up the 55-plus community. I mean,
so
that's a part of the MDR?
It could be. So this is just looking at kind of what is the overall type of use within the, in terms of typology.
Yeah.
You could have a 55-unit single-family neighborhood. You could have a 55-unit multifamily development, all sorts mm-hmm. of ways to get there. And so it could be accommodated in the MDR zone.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, I think of it like with that big lot, one north of Napa there that,
mm-hmm.
that I mean, it depends how big of a community you want, you know,
yeah.
of course, but these smaller ones would not, and smaller infill would not, I don't think, fit the need. I mean, we need a lot, essentially. Mm-hmm. But
that was a previous suggestion with the docket received for Torgerson's properties adjacent to Torgerson Park was he was specifically after doing a senior housing development.
No, there's just some proposed, like, they didn't have to annex a lot of property, and it was pretty difficult to do.
We've got the people.
I think we should have it written as something of a goal.
Could be something that we provide some additional incentive for. That's what we want to see at certain areas.
Because that's a form of affordable housing.
I just briefly mentioned it, but I'd like to zero in at least. Get it right, we should be thinking about Habitat for Humanity. That has a strong need in every community.
Yeah, so David's actually going to be coming back to you. You recall he gave the presentation on housing affordability, and there's a number of ways to get there. So he'll be coming back with additional recommendations and looking for your feedback on other ways to get there, and Habitat for Humanity would be a very programmatic way to address that.
Yeah. You're also, I think Habitat for Humanity, until you see it, it puts a heart in the community. Mm-hmm. I mean, it says, okay, we have people among us who aren't as well off as we are. We make it a place for them, right? The best spot we can, which is right where they put it in Snoqualmie. They didn't waste any time doing that. They saw the need. And I think that just created a different feeling about soul quality by having that there. They would do the same thing with Mark Penn. Mm-hmm. And we'd provide a hell of a service.
Do we have a motion to extend the meeting till 9:30?
I'll make that motion.
Okay. Yeah, no, I don't think we will. But then I'll have to do it twice.
I'll second.
Second, all right. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
So I'm hearing general consensus then to at least put it out to the public of these are areas that we're considering based on what I've provided. I haven't really heard take it off or add to it.
Yeah, I think okay. Just discuss it a little bit more here. Just kind of talking out loud on some of these things and trying to see how they play out. Because in some ways, number 7 seemed more desirable to me because of the park.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you've mentioned that, Mike, that, you know, there were people, I mean, I know people would like living next to the park, and people, it seems like they tend to take care of things if it's kind of their backyard, so I don't think there'd be any issues in that regard. I do get concerned about what many citizens call a rural character of North Bend, and I think that's bigger lots and bigger areas. So, how do we make sure that we're honoring that?
I think from the overall comprehensive planning standpoint, we're providing that at the outer edges of the city with our constrained low density residential, and we have a lot of conventional single family. This is following the council's direction to provide more density at the core of the city.
And I'm not going to be on this commission, you know, forever, and not a whole lot longer. So the thing is, though, I mean, I can approve this extension out, but it's like, okay, well, another 3 years, well, let's just go a little bit farther. And that's what concerns me, I guess. Like, we have to at some point, if we want to preserve the rural character, we can't keep extending it out. I mean, do you agree with that, or would you?
I agree. I guess that it's multiple and competing objectives. You also have to look at affordability, and the best way to address affordability is density, because of land costs. Yeah.
And probably the density is going to be more centralized in the downtown or along a major road. I mean, it's not going to. I wouldn't think it's going to continue to creep into the existing LDR, into the CLDR, I mean,
yeah.
Naturally.
Yeah. The missing middle examples you provided us are interesting to look at the design that they're intended to do, you know, these little small hotels and things, but the architecture is a little, so I worry about somebody getting the idea this is where we're going to be going, is we're going to going more towards a city look. They actually have a three-story structure in there. That's each level is a room, is a residence. But it shows a Northwest architecture, and I certainly strive to keep that kind of architecture going rather than going into more of a suburban urban look. That's not where we are. That's what attracted me about this little community across from the firehouse, still calling. It clearly is a Northwest look.
So the look of development is a function of the design standards, and our design standards don't call for a particular architectural style, but there are elements that do promote more of the kind of Northwest mountain character that we have in North Bend with heavier eaves, natural materials,
tell me we can't control what kind of buildings we have to put in this town.
No, we can, and that's the design standards.
Yeah, I mean, with that, with number nine, the larger lot, you can have on that, I want the access up North Bend Way is kind of narrow there. You could have businesses potentially on both sides, kind of like the entrance to this Better Way. Mm-hmm. And then have, you could have a 55-plus community back there, plus a variety of medium dense residential. It's just, I don't know how that would work. Someone would buy that whole parcel and then... A lot of that wouldn't be seen from the road either.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you were to buy that property and the commercial properties in front of it, you could do a really neat mixed-use project just with the existing zoning.
But how could you buy all those? Are all individually owned, aren't they?
The front, the front ones.
Yeah, you have to buy from separate owners.
$100 bill.
You also got the graveyard right next to it.
Yeah,
that's not moving.
So I think I've got direction from you on getting the area resolved. I wanted to come back to some of the broader questions about use and ecology. So do you guys concur that the mix that we saw in the missing middle pages that I included here is what we're after? So a mix of townhomes, duplexes, triplexes, the bungalow court type of apartments.
That is what I gave you. I think we that close to home. I think we can get our city council to look at that with close to home. They will never get a better example of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's right there.
Yeah.
But I think it all goes.
Okay.
For MDR, I lean more towards the left side of that list of on that missing middle website. The duplex, triplex, fourplex.
Yeah.
I, when you get to the multiplex and live work, I think that is outside of what we're really looking for in these plots.
Yeah, I think the fourplex is about the top end of where you'd want to be just for compatibility with it, more of a rural type of urban.
Townhouses could work. I think that's a little high density. Mm-hmm. Higher density than what I think these lots would make sense for. But definitely, I really like, especially for the Silver Creek one, duplex and triplex I think would work really well in there. You know, you get that really works well with infill, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about the Napa lot, you're looking at more of something like the Kimball Creek where you're, because it's one lot, you can really do something with that, with a little bit of the commercial inside of it. And you can do a little bit higher density because it's out of sight.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that kind of density makes sense in the other lots.
Yeah, so keeping it up limited to four.
Something like that,
yeah.
I think I'm sort of more on the, like I said before, letting design control a lot of different things, and I'm all for a lot of flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
I do like the idea of live work, at least allowing that to happen. I can think of a lot of examples, like somebody who teaches yoga or somebody who's an accountant who might have a small business on their main floor but live upstairs.
Mm-hmm. And live work doesn't have to be associated with a particular typology or density.
So
it can just be a storefront in a small building.
I'm thinking more like a four-story building with commercial at the bottom. That wouldn't make sense.
It sounds like
no, it'd be a two-story.
Right.
It could be a two-story building.
Yeah.
Or two-story flats or apartments or townhouses where I've even seen one where the work is basically the living room, and behind the work is actually the resident's kitchen. But during the day, it's not used as a kitchen. It's used as the person's office. So.
The hard part for me though with that, and specifically with the lots we're talking about, is there's not a lot of, if you're doing a business, there's not a lot of visibility.
Right.
Right. It is like more specifically than Apple lot. Right. You're not going to have, I guess you could have commercial or a store or something, but there's no visibility there, right?
Yeah.
Behind another commercial.
Generally, live work wouldn't be retail. It would be something like I think yoga studio, because I'm familiar with the yoga studio on Bendigo.
Or an accountant, or
yeah.
Even like an Edward Jones type of
Yeah, exactly. You don't
you
need
still
a lot of visibility.
You still want visibility for that, though, aren't you?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Not necessarily.
If you have any pictures or names of developments.
Redmond, the classic one, is called Lionsgate.
Yeah.
It was one of the first live-work on the east side. Now, that has more visibility. It's along major streets.
And it's
but,
a bigger scale. I mean,
but yeah, I mean, I know I have friends or relatives that have little small businesses and, you know, not in this state, but, you know, they operate out of a live-work unit and it's in the middle of a mixed-use neighborhood.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that's up to the potential renter or purchaser to decide what it works for them.
Right.
I have a weird question, maybe, real quick. Back to the second one where I'm writing right now. That, the part of the street that's a private road, becomes private. Well, how does this work when that, there's like 6 miles of that private road?
Yeah, so any further subdivision on a private road, we have a rule that you can only have up to 4 homes on a private road, and then beyond that, you need to dedicate it to the public so that it doesn't have access problems and emergency access.
Thank you.
Access.
I have a question. Just on duplex and townhouse, I don't think it really matters all that much, but I think there may be overlap in those terms. So it says townhouse can be 2 to 8 side to side, and duplex, 2 dwelling units, one next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's just overlap and what that's.
Yeah, you can have. It almost becomes more of a form issue than it does, because you could have a 2-unit duplex and a 2-unit townhouse.
Yeah.
Townhouses tend to be more vertical. 2 or 3 stories.
I think a townhouse is you own a side of the building up and down.
Yeah.
A duplex, it's more one story.
Stacked.
Or sorry, yeah, stacked.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we just stayed over the New Year's Eve and side by side. Which I think you can tell.
Yeah, you see duplexes in that so called image. They've got garages on the ends with the living in the center. So, on the wall, so you got pretty good noise control there.
Yeah, it seemed to be pretty good. We stayed in one where there was the garage on the bottom, and then it was, you have to have stairs, so it's not good for older folks in there. That's the only problem with those. Otherwise, you could fit people in there, and I think they're affordable, but we couldn't hear anything, so it seemed to be pretty, I don't know, a good housing option, I think.
So the other primary way to address the allowed typologies in here is, and what the Missing Middle website recommends, is to not prescribe density, but instead prescribe form. So if you're defining the outside dimensions of what that building can be, it doesn't matter if you have 2 units, 4 units, 6 units within that, because it's going to maintain that same look that would be compatible with a single family home. And so that's a big question of, would our community be comfortable with that idea? And I guess, do you recommend approaching it in that way, or do we go to a conventional zoning or density range?
I think that would work in a downtown area more than a neighborhood. Lived in Coos Bay for a while, and in that neighborhood, the corners were duplexes, and then the streets were single family. Mm-hmm. You never could pick out the duplex from a single family because the corner had 2 driveways, you know, for the duplex, and the other driveways for the single one, and it is blended, so you have multifamily going for you on each corner. So if 2 blocks, you have 8 multifamilies, and the rest of them are single families. And like you say, it's form.
Mm-hmm.
But it's control. They didn't provide for multi-level in that community, because single-level residences. But you don't see the mix and match in that setup. I happen to begin to think, in my aging years, the mix and match is kind of cool. You get too much the same is boring.
Yep.
And it's not that I could walk around Seattle, but when I do, I take notice of the differences. It's interesting.
And that's something that I also wanted to suggest, is if you're on a larger site, say bigger than 2 acres, the rules for the medium density residential zone would require a mix of typology, so you don't get 10 in the same day.
I think that might be what people are looking for these days. They don't get tricked. They're not stereotyped into this performance. And I also call the difference in my neighborhood where I live, where large lots rarely see each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have this grand lifestyle, but I get tired of looking at Washington. So. She doesn't hate to. So I think that difference is okay. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
But I find that more to the two of us of the downtown area where that really is looked for.
I think it should be on the table.
Okay.
I kind of agree with Dick. I'm not sure that all three of the areas that we're considering would be right for not having specific density controls, but I think it should be something.
Okay. Another primary question that I wanted to ask about is, what do you think about allowing one-off new single-family homes to be constructed on existing lots?
One. You can't come in and build five as a single person. Get one.
So the advantage of that is it gives more flexibility to individual owners. The disadvantage is it could wind up just filling up the zone. Probably wouldn't happen between North Bend Way and Cedar Falls Way because of that property value issue, but in other areas it could happen.
Yeah, even behind, in the area 6, you would think, again, it's all based on if you can build 2 units, then you're going to have more profit than one, so economies of scale.
My first thought is, we shouldn't. If we want to designate the zone.
Mm-hmm.
Is it just to allow flexibility? Mm-hmm.
If somebody's got their lot already and they've got their retirement plan and
they haven't presented to the city yet, mm-hmm. and now all of a sudden they can't. So kind of, could that be a docket situation though? Or that wouldn't be just for them, right? Can't do that.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. So that could come up when you send a notice to the
You know, like along Thrasher. Let's say one of those lots they wanted to redevelop and put a nice single family home, but then your neighbor wanted to do MDR, and if you say you can't, all of those will not. They can't redevelop as existing single family. They'd have to be something else.
Last question on that. So are you suggesting that an existing single family home can be torn down and replaced with a single family? Or if a lot's large enough to be divided that, let's say, 2 single family houses can be built on it?
Think my thought, I wasn't getting into the subdivision idea, but just if you have a vacant lot or if you wanted to tear down the existing, could you build a conventional single family?
Yeah, I would, again, all for flexibility, I would say allow it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's how I personally would lean, just for...
Yeah, the land value is going to...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If the land value is a big deal, if somebody said, I'm giving this to my kids as an inheritance,
mm-hmm.
this vacant property I own, the kids want to build a house on it because they got the property for free, essentially,
yeah.
and it's where they want to live, they'll let them build a house.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess the final primary question is, do we want to tie in affordability by limiting the size of a unit that you could build within this zone? So you could do townhomes, for example. Townhomes could be luxury townhomes that are 3,000 square feet each, and that could kill the overlying goal of trying to make this affordable workforce housing. Ultimately, your primary means of true affordability would be in your multifamily zone where you've got economies of scale to make the units less costly. Here you've got smaller building sizes, which drives up the price of each unit, but it's still a more affordable alternative to conventional single family. So the question is, do we try to constrain that box to keep it more affordable?
I wouldn't want to see it at 100% affordable housing. Right, I wouldn't want to say they have to be affordable housing as in terms of what that definition.
No, we're not talking about right. getting into defining, you know, 30%.
Right. But I think that, yeah, we there should be some constraints to make sure this doesn't get out of hand. Mm-hmm. Right. The idea here is we want affordable housing out of this zone.
Okay.
I think there are already some constraints built in there, looking at number two on the staff report. You know, we have the cottage housing, which is mostly 1,200 square feet or less. I think B and C are open for size right now. Maybe that's what you were saying, Mike. Those could be, that might be good, I guess, if we want to leave some option for something higher level. But then apartments in general should be affordable, I hope. And then 800 square feet or less homes.
Yeah.
For tiny homes.
Yeah. And then tiny homes at 400.
So we're allowing for it, but we're not requiring.
True.
So
excluding mobile homes. this could include mobiles.
Manufactured can, well, typically manufactured are allowed where single family is allowed. Mm-hmm. So yes,
so
you.
So that's part of the two.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I see what you're saying. So they could just choose 40 acres of townhomes and then.
That are not. Affordable.
Yeah,
3,000 square foot townhomes.
Yeah.
I think that's the issue, right?
Yeah.
The size of the unit.
The size of the unit and the size of the property. I think you wouldn't apply this if it's just one lot, but if you've got more than 2 acres or whatever that threshold is, then maybe you say 10% of your units are going to have to be under a certain size.
I think we'd want to look at it like we did the cottage housing and have some size restriction. Because, the townhome we stayed in was probably like 2,500 square foot. It was not affordable. I mean, it wasn't expensive or luxury, but it could have been smaller to make it available to a wider market.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something we'd have to spend some time on, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think adding in the 55-plus, which I think you're already going to do, and there is a typology.
Well, that's not a typology. That's more just an ownership renter occupancy thing, which we typically don't get involved in.
And but it's allowed.
They can do it.
I guess it could fall under the 800 square feet or less, potentially, type of home, a smaller home.
It could be part of your description of the zone to provide for senior housing, to provide affordability, kind of the intent of the zone.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then
the words there might give some.
Well, yeah, it gives direction, but.
Where are we talking about MRs out there at 436 Bend Way community? It's a fairly undeveloped area, so they would lend itself to put in, you know, a newer community.
The part that's gray?
Everything between, south of North Bend Way and east of 436.
Well, we do have a little cluster going in there, so that we've got the New River Run Apartments. You guys just did a development agreement on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then north of there, we've got the Dahlgren Apartments.
Right.
That's a fairly large multifamily development.
Yeah. And there's some loosey-goosey properties to the east of that.
Mm-hmm.
North Bend Way that would easily flip into something they can make some money on. But it seems like we have a neighborhood business zone in there. Seems like a pocket that's ready for it anymore.
Yeah, council has, for that property, they really have wanted to reserve the employment potential there. The property owner would like to see a mixture of uses.
If the council wants out there to get their devil, do it.
Yeah, we are actually.
We've been wanting that for years.
Yeah.
Why does somebody get out and find a buyer?
Yeah, we just met with the property owner, and we paired them with a business that wants to locate from Redmond, relocate. So they're not opposed to some residential, but they don't want to see it all be residential.
Like if it was a live work or something.
Right, or just a mixture of things, not just all one. There's not a lot of pockets of EP1 left. Mm-hmm. But that's just been their thoughts, you know. And it's getting further out, and you've got other multifamily.
We're close to having to extend our time. We can.
I appreciate the feedback.
Yeah, great job.
Okay, so next meeting will be...
Oh, yeah. So we heard from a few that February 14th was okay, but we haven't heard from the rest of you.
Yeah, I've got a number of you said either day. I heard one go for the 14th, one go for the 13th. So we need to break the tie here.
I'll do the 13th.
13th?
Why is the 14th?
The 14th is just Valentine's Day, so I wanted to know it.
Yeah, I may have something coming up on the 14th.
Okay.
Kind of committed to that.
So we'll go for the 13th then, sounds like.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now you have to do something.
Your beautiful wife is waiting.
Put a heart on that date.
You put a heart.
And then do we want to talk about the agenda there for the next meeting? The 24th? I see some items down there.
Yes.
Correct.
So you will be... having the marijuana development come to you. So this is a proposal to allow a marijuana retail use at a property outside of where marijuana retail is currently allowed. Right now we just allow it out basically at the outlet mall within the interchange commercial zone at exit 31. We haven't seen marijuana retail go in there. It relates to a lot of issues with regard to the loans on that property being federally tied. So an applicant has inquired about allowing it on a property on North Bend Way. There's pros and cons to it. We want to bring it forward to you through a development agreement, which is an authorization that ultimately that the council has the authority to approve to allow a use where it's not otherwise allowed under conventional the city's development regulations. We'll be introducing that at your next meeting, and then we'll be having the hearing on February 13th for that.
What is the building?
Right now, it's just a single-family home, 1310.
It's kind of those group of four white buildings.
Yeah.
That are
open
for sale.
And the proposal would be to use one of the single-family homes to convert it into the retail store, and that would be as an interim. And then within 3 years, they build a permanent commercial building to contain the marijuana retail and then other commercial uses.
Coffee shop or something we've talked about.
Okay. Did you just say a coffee shop?
So it'll be really interesting to see what the public has to say about that.
Hey, you'll get some people to come.
I was just curious, yeah, so I typed online, and for like Maple Valley and Bellevue and all that, and there was like 25, 30 people that came and commented, so it'll be interesting. It could be lengthy, I don't know, we might, if you get a heads up, we might want to do that senior center. I don't know, I mean, we haven't had, there's only been a couple topics where we've had a gigantic turnout, but All right. Well, I'll make a motion to adjourn.
I'll make the motion.
You can make it. All right, then I'll second.
I move adjourn.
Second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.